welcome to episode 50 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, a very special episode, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, the Commentary. I'm Jerry Shario, and I have, as usual, the privilege of introducing to you the head honcho of this hootenanny. You've seen him on stage, you've seen him on screen, but you will never see him on this podcast. It's Nick Santa Maria.
And it just so happens that honcho is my favorite Marx brother. That's great. Yeah. But the head honcho. Okay. Honcho, doesn't it sound like a Latin word? Honcho? Mm-hmm. Like, I wonder if there is a translation. Any of our Spanish-speaking audience out there, let us know if honcho is actually a word in Spanish, because it really could be. Okay, we'll be back next week with another show. And we hope you enjoyed that, our little exploration into words that we don't understand. Jerry's starting off the bat with this fake laughter. And and I'm matching him. Laugh for laugh. Fake laugh for fake laugh. Anyway, no, let's get down to business here. This is a very special episode, Jerry. You're right.
Yes.
It's number 50. And as far as things like age are concerned, everybody told me that 40 was going to be my nightmare age. You know, the age where you realize, uh-oh, there's no turning back. This is it. Well, I didn't feel that way. The 40s were my favorite decade and probably my busiest and my most successful. It was 50 that really set me back. That was the one where I thought, oh my God, I didn't accomplish half the things I wanted to, blah, blah, blah. So this is a very important episode. This is the one where we look at everything and we think, why did we do this? Okay, so that's not true at all. So we are doing a commentary. Now, here's an interesting thing. My writing partner, Matthew Conium, who was recently in the country, in our country, for the first time. He went to New York to do a Marx Brother event. And how nice that he and his wife, Angela, and his wonderful little son, Edward, came to visit our country. Welcome and come back soon. Anyway, I don't know why I brought this up. We wrote a book. It's called The Annotated Abbott and Costello. If you don't have it, you really should. It's the definitive book about the films of Abbott and Costello, even usurping an old one from 30-something years ago. But anyway, this book will take you by the hand through the world of the movies of Abbott and Costello. Now, this movie, if you've read the book, or even if you haven't, this movie happens to be my favorite of their films. I don't think it's as funny as Whodunit. I don't think it's as representative as Whodunit, which is basically all Abbott and Costello, complete with the burlesque routines and all the stuff we love about them. And there's no songs, you know? So it's just straightforward, hilarious Abbott and Costello. This one, I believe it's my favorite because, number one, it's got a very strong story. Okay, and this was the time where Abbott and Costello were filming strong stories rather than what they were doing during the war, which was basically Abbott and Costello routine, song, song, routine, song, routine, routine, song, and then the end title after a chase. And that was pretty much what those movies were. And they were wonderful. No complaints. Loved every one of them. But things changed. Once they came upon 1945 and the end of the war, they filmed something called Little Giant, and then they followed it up with Time of Their Lives, two very, very strong, story-heavy movies. They had to do that. Things were changing in Hollywood. Things were changing with comedies in general. Laurel and Hardy made their last really starring American film in 1945. The Marx Brothers were pretty much retired at that point. They came back to make a couple of movies, but that was really it. Fields was 1 year away from death. Keaton was writing gags for other people. Chaplin was still making films, but him, you know, with Chaplin, it's like it takes 3 years for him to get a film out. And Harold Lloyd was was responsible for more, how can I put this, for more babies around the country than most any other celebrity, Hollywood celebrity. Way to go, Harold. You not only, you hung from a clock, but you were well hung from a clock, apparently. So anyway, Harold was doing that. But Abbott and Costello were like right smack dab in the middle of their Universal International careers. And those careers were taking the form of strong stories rather than, you know, willy-nilly musicals, whatever. So where is this in their canon? Where does it come? You've got Wistful Widow of Wagon Gap before that, before Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And afterwards, you have, what follows? A Mexican Hayride. Yep. So you've got two very plot-heavy movies without many routines that they'd, you know, done time and time again. And things are different. And, you know, a lot of people, well, you know what? Maybe we should start the film because I could be talking during the film. Oy. So, yeah, we're looking at Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, 1948, at Universal International. So let's do the countdown. Everybody, put your discs in, your DVDs, or however else you watch it. We are going to begin right at the Universal logo on Jerry's cue. Here we go.
Yep, right from the original, as Nick likes to say, Universal International logo. That's our starting point.
Well, you do that
Thank
very
you.
Well.
Thank you very much. Okay, and so here we go. Mm-hmm. 3, 2, 1, play.
And there's that wonderful Frank Skinner score that's repeated all during their Universal International Meet the Monsters movies. Okay, yeah. Now right off the bat, if you're a fan of our book, you know this already. But this animation, for years, was believed to be done by Walter Lantz and his studio, because Walter Lantz released his cartoons through Universal. Oh, by the way, that scream you heard from Costello, it came back in many more movies, by the way. and I'm wondering, why didn't Bud do a scream? Bud's is like at random. And look at this now. My late friend Michael Schlesinger used to have this on a T-shirt. And I used to envy him. I wanted it so badly. So anyway, oh, there's Lenore Aubert. So anyway, and there's our dream team, Robert Lees, Frederick Rinaldo, and John Grant. They're best writers, as far as I'm concerned. Charles Van Enger, the director of photography, should have been nominated for an Oscar. And Bud Westmore was using his new techniques after they got rid of Jack Pierce, who was, you know, busy gluing yak hair, one hair at a time, on Lon Chaney's face. And there's Charles T. Barton. There he is. He's the guy. Probably my favorite Abbott and Costello director. And there's a couple of shots here that we've seen before in the mid-40s horror movies. I'm thinking of Frankenstein meets the... No, not Frankenstein meets the Wolfman. Ghost of Frankenstein? Anyway, it's one of them. And there is Lon Chaney looking blind. Okay, so here we are. We're talking about the animation. It was not Walter Lantz. I got in touch with my good friend, Jerry Beck, probably the preeminent expert on animation. And he told me that it was done by, are you ready? Dave Fleischer's company. When the Fleischer brothers were given the old heave-ho by Paramount, Max pretty much did his own thing. But Dave created a company where he would do kind of like consultant work, you know, and he did it for years at Universal. And these 2 years, 48 and 49, he was on the outs. Walter Lantz was on the outs with Universal. He was releasing through United Artists. So this was more than likely Dave Fleischer and his company doing that wonderful animation. Okay, now here's Chick and Wilbur, Wilbur Gray and Chick Young, which is the name of the guy who created Blondie and Dagwood, which I think is interesting. And and Bud and Lou are in Florida as baggage handlers. And, whoops. And there, and that was really Lou. He didn't go for the stuntman that time. And Bud actually did a little work there. He lifted a bag. And there she is, Lenore Aubert, who seems to be very concerned with Lou's head. Look at this. I love this. Does this hurt? No. Does this hurt? No. You know, when you watch the outtakes from this film and you see these two working together, she's having a ball. She's really enjoying herself. And I think Lou is too. Well, wouldn't you be? Now, here's one of the themes in this movie I love. The beautiful women seem to be madly in love with Lou, and Bud just can't understand it. And there's a line that I can't believe got past the censors when Lou looks at her and says, "Frankly, I don't get it." And she says, "And frankly, you never will." I wonder what she was referring to. Okay, now Lou's going to answer the phone. I'm going to be a little bit more descriptive because a lot of people only listen to this podcast like in the car or whatever. They won't be watching along with us. So I want to explain what's going on at any given time. I also want to mention that we have a special guest here as a third member of this commentary, and it happens to be the ghost of Bud Abbott. He decided to come by and help us, and we're very grateful. Thank you, Bud.
Quiet.
Okay. All right. Calm down. All right. Just relax. When you want to jump in and comment on something, feel free. Okay. Because you were in the movie, for crying out loud. Okay.
Look at him. Look, he's holding his finger out like he lost his canary.
All right. Shut up. Just be quiet. Okay. So we're watching the movie. And Lou is on the phone with London. And here we go. This is actually the second time they filmed this transition. The first time wasn't quite good enough, so they went back and did it again. And I'm sure Lon had a couple of stiff ones to get through this because regardless of Bud Westmore making it easier, it was still kind of a process he had to go through. And it's interesting because they used measuring tools and vices and things like that to keep his head in the proper position, that it wouldn't move at all. So they were very careful about that. And here he is ripping the chair to pieces. I love that, by the way.
Yeah.
It's just such a great effect. You know, and you know those pieces were already there, you know, ready to be thrown around. Now here's Frank Ferguson. Frank Ferguson is Mr. McDougal. He's the one that ordered those bodies of the remains of Count Dracula and the Frankenstein monster for his House of Horrors. And that is something that, and this is funny, watching it now that I live in Florida, this is something that would be in Florida, a House of Horrors. They have things like that here. So Frank Ferguson, just a wonderful character actor. This is one of 14 films he made this year.
Wow.
And he was one of the original directors and actors and whatever at the Pasadena Playhouse. He was also a screenwriter. You see his name on several films. Frank Ferguson, very talented guy. Great foil for Bud and Lou. And I love this little exchange between the two of them, between McDougal and Sandra Mornay. Now, I have my theories about Sandra Mornay.
Yes.
She's very quiet about, you know, her background, right? And there's that scene between her and Count Dracula where Dracula mentions that she's wanted by the European police for very strange experiments. Now, that says to me, Nazi. She's a Nazi on the run. She's deadly. She doesn't care what she does to people. Later on, she threatens to operate on Lou without ether, without any anesthetic. I mean, she's a tough cookie, this one. In real life, she was handed a bad hand. She came to America. She was hired by Samuel Goldwyn to do the Bob Hope movie, They Got Me Covered, which is one of my least favorite. And whatchamacallit, he hit on her very heavily. And when she refused his advances, you know, because we know that Samuel Goldwyn was such a looker. she said, "No, Sam, sorry. No, Sammy, I'm going to Alabama." And he put the kibosh on her career. She was a very talented actress. She could have been another Ingrid Bergman, actually. And he just blacklisted her. So she only made a few more films and never in a starring position where she belonged. And she retired in 1952 because of it. Good old Sam Goldwyn. Here's one of my favorite jokes in the movie. Okay. I'm a union man and I only work 16 hours a day. I belong to two unions. Thank you, John Grant. I love when he imitates him. So here we are at McDougal's House of Horrors, the delivery entrance. And both Abbott and Costello had a good delivery.
Yes.
Okay. I love that shot where he throws the keys and the camera follows the keys right to Luke.
Yes. And I have to say, this is perhaps the most we've ever seen Bud actually work in any of these movies.
You've got a point there. Wait a minute. I take umbrage to that. Wait a minute. Let me look up umbrage. Yes, yes. I take umbrage. Okay, Bud, calm down. Just sit down. Here's a drink. And here's 16,000 cigarettes. There you go. Okay. So this, I love the look of this scene, the lighting, the where the lights go out and the lightning is still flashing. This reminds me so much of Biffle and Schuster, Bride of Finkelstein. This is what they were trying to emulate, this look in the laboratory. And they did quite well, actually. I love that shot. It's so scary. All the wax figures and the dark lighting. Dummy, nothing. He was smart enough to scam me. Okay. And I love their 1940s Eisenhower jackets that they're wearing, you know?
Yeah.
Those short jackets. They look great. Lou's in great shape. Bud is too. I have to say, this is one of my favorite Bud Abbott performances in this movie. Thank you. It's okay. Don't worry about it. But seriously, I think Bud is fantastic in this movie. He really acts the part, and he has an arc. He actually has an arc, his character, where he's non-believing. He starts seeing some strange things. He starts believing, and then boom, he believes. So he goes through that whole journey where he has to catch up with Lou. Hurry back. And this is another thing. I love the, chick. There's something about that word, chick. Oh, chick. And oh, chick, you know? And he must be a relative of, oh, Chuck. Oh, Chuck from Hold That Ghost. See, even here, look at Bud, how he handles the scene. He's very good. Bud is very good.
Yeah.
Okay. So here they are. They're unpacking. And thunder crashes and puts out the lights. Oh, chick. Okay, now this is interesting because there are only a few recognizable routines in this movie. One of them is very brief, and we'll get to it when we get to it. But this one is the moving candle bit, which they did play to the hilt in Hold That Ghost. But in Hold That Ghost, they couldn't explain why the candle was moving. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it scared Lou and, you know, we thought it was a ghost and blah, blah, blah. In this one, there's a definite reason why the candle is moving. And for me, it works better because there's a threat behind it.
Yep.
It's moving because Count Dracula is trying to get out of his coffin. Now, there's a bit more at stake at this point. And I love this, that Lou can't avoid reading the card about Count Dracula. And look how messed up it is. Did you see how wrinkled it is?
Mm-hmm.
It's been used. Let's put it that way. So is Lenore Aubert. Quiet, Bud. That's a little dirty. Stop that. Sorry. Oh, and ow! I forgot to do that. All right. Here, keep drinking. All right, so... The first time he hears the coffin, the lid makes that sound. In person. this whole exchange is just fantastic. The whole thing, the whole setup to the candles, the candle moving, Bud explaining to Lou that none of it is true. Get busy, come on. Okay, Bud, we heard him. Okay, so Lou can't avoid reading it like a child. You know, it's like, yeah, don't look at that dead cat. When you're a kid, it's like, no, I got to look at it. I want to see it. There it is. That could be a shot from the original Dracula when his hand comes out and Lou sees it. Oh, God. And we're reminded of Mel Brooks just extolling compliments on Lou's scared takes, saying it was the best in the business. And boy, was he right. Certainly. All right. Quiet. But does Dracula know it? this is terrific stuff. Now, Bud keeps walking off, and I'm wondering what he's doing. What is he doing over there? What is his work? You know, what is he doing? We don't know.
No.
I mean, Lou is folding the canvas. He's getting it ready. And he can't help but read the Dracula legend. And there goes the candle. And he's got to call Bud from whatever he's doing. I mean, Bud could be on the phone, you know, placing casino bets. We don't know. This is great. I love how the camera comes up to him. Now we know it's serious. Lou is scared. He is scared, and he has every reason to be, and he can't even get the words out. I love this. And the final look he gives, he looks down at the coffin. You know, I don't even have to watch this film. I could do it from memory. It's just amazing. And now he can't explain it. Trying to tell me this candle moved. It's not moving, is it, Bud? No, it's not emotionally moving, if that's what you mean. No, that's not what I mean. Okay, so now he walks away, and hopefully Lou won't read that legend again, but he can't help it. He's got the mind of an 8-year-old, and I'll bet he was glad to get rid of it. Okay, so by drinking the blood of his victims, and there goes the candle. Can you imagine owning that candle?
Yeah.
I would love that. Okay. Now Bela gets out of the coffin. Now Bela, as far as I'm concerned, is the number 3 person in this movie. You've got Bud and Lou and Bela. He is just fantastic. I call it his swan song. This is his last experience in an A movie in a top studio. From here on in, it was independent trash, really, sub-level movies, even though they're enjoyable on their own merits. But this is his last go-round with a major studio and his last time playing Count Dracula, and only the second time in his entire career that he played Count Dracula. In 1943, he did a movie for Columbia called The Return of the Vampire, but he wasn't officially Count Dracula, but he might as well have been. But anyway, this is his last go-round, and he was very happy to get this. There is a legend about him, Universal not wanting to use him. They were looking at other people and blah, blah, blah. The truth of the matter is, Bela was on their plate right from the beginning. And he was signed, you know, with more than enough time. It wasn't like a last minute thing, like a lot of people said. And about 3 weeks after the film was released, I believe that he was on their radio show, their ABC radio show.
Yeah.
And they did a big haunted house sketch, you know, whatever. And this one was famous because Bela screws up the final joke. I mean, he's Hungarian, you know, he kind of screwed it up. You know, those Los Angeles cops, you know, it's just, it was bad, but bad, right?
Terrible.
Okay. What did you do to Bela after that happened? Oh, okay. I thought so. Okay. So Bela's getting back into the coffin. And this is funny. The squeaking from the coffin lid is confusing Lou because he thinks it's the sound of the nails coming out of the crate where the Frankenstein monster is. Now, when I was a kid, this scene right now, right here, was all important. The reveal when he takes the Excelsior away from the monster's face, it was like a holiday for me. It was just, it was everything. So here they are. Help me with this Excelsior. I know, we're hearing it, but don't worry. There it is. That shot, I swear to you, it's indelible in my brain. And then, Lou caused the head to be cut off on the guillotine. And here comes McDougal right on cue. This is great. Okay, while we're doing this, there's a couple of things I want to mention. Number one, my very first memory of seeing this film, it came to me the other day. My memory came, you know, washing over me. Basically, we moved from Brooklyn, where my dad owned a brownstone, and he sold the brownstone, and we bought a home in the suburb on Long Island, Massapequa. And all of a sudden, we were in a middle class, you know, house. It had three stories. It was beautiful, but we couldn't afford furniture yet. And so there was no carpet on the floor. There were very few pieces of furniture. And we had one TV. It was like a 16-inch black and white TV with the antenna ears on top. Well, we had it down in the living room where we didn't have a window treatment for the front window yet. So the sun would shine on the screen and you couldn't see the picture. So my brothers and I knew that Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein was coming on that afternoon at the height of the sun coming through the window. So we, all three of us, went up to the third floor, went on this little landing, and the three of us laid on our stomachs watching the movie down on the second floor at an angle so we wouldn't get the sun blocking the picture. And that's the first memory I have of watching this movie. And it was fantastic. I could still remember. I was in the middle, and I remember my brothers shaking with laughter, you know, and I'm feeling the vibrations. But the thing with me was, I was scared. I don't know about you, Jerry, but when I was a kid, this movie scared me, especially the Wolfman.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That is, to me, the major selling point of this film is that the monsters are treated respectfully in that sense. And it is. It is very scary. In fact, if I may, a spoiler alert here coming up in a second, I know your least favorite part of this whole movie is coming up right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like you, it's a joke I loved when I was a child. I thought it was so funny.
Yep.
And as I got older, I just realized that it kind of went against what they were doing, you know, making the monsters completely serious and a complete threat. So this was kind of a cheap joke as far as I'm concerned. Look at that big fella. Boy, they had to dub that. I'll bet it just didn't come out clearly behind the cape.
Yeah.
He never went to the cape. No, not that cape. Just relax, bud. Have another cigarette. There you go. Okay, so now here they are going into McDougal's House of Horrors. McDougal is here, and the insurance investigator is also here. I believe that's Gil Stratton. I believe his son was a famous athlete. Gil Stratton Jr. I could be wrong. Now, Lou, watch Lou. You can't take your eyes off him here. He's not saying a word, and he's completely stealing the scene, trying in pantomime to explain what just happened. I remember watching this with a room full of Korean ship workers that I show. I was a comedian on the cruise ships, and I showed this movie at a midnight showing, and all the Korean crew showed up, and they laughed so hard. Whenever Lou did this kind of thing, they were hysterical. And look how easily he picks up the coffin. I always like that. Come. There he goes. Now, what did they do? Did they just walk down the street? They left at the exit, and the Frankenstein monster carrying a coffin, and you've got this guy in a tuxedo and a cape. You know, it's like, would they take the subway? Okay, there's the famous universal bat that kind of floats. Bat wings move very fast, you know, almost like hummingbirds.
Yeah.
And this one is like leisure. It's like he stopped for a cigarette, you know?
A what?
No. Keep smoking. Just don't worry. But relax. It's still kind of cool. I still think the bat is cool. Now, here we go. More Dave Fleischer work. Some people don't like this. They think it's too phony. I think it's absolutely brilliant. Look at that.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous. Just gorgeous. And the house has one knocker. They should have tried to get him to hit his fingers and he go, oh, ow, ow, ow. Okay. They have a past. Something I didn't really, you know, I've seen this movie maybe more than any other movie I've ever seen, along with Duck Soup with the Marx Brothers. But I'm just realizing now they've had a past. That opening dialogue was all about their past. So yeah. She's into some pretty, pretty heavy duty stuff. If you're with the Prince of Darkness, you know, amazing. I love this set. Now, do you see the chair there?
Yeah.
My buddy Michael Schlesinger, the guy responsible for the Biffle and Schuster movies, the last movie he made was a spoof of Seven Keys to Baldpate, which was a play by George M. Cohan. But he actually got that chair from Universal and used it in the movie. How about that?
Wow.
I was so jealous. I was so jealous. Look at her, how beautiful she is. Now, there's Lenore Aubert in close-up, and I can only imagine how beautiful the color of her eyes must be. Look, you can tell. They're languid, they're limpid, they're gorgeous. Speaking of gorgeous, Bela is gorgeous. Look at him. Unmanageable brute. He's 66 years old. He's a year younger than I am here, and he looks great. He looks great, and he acts great. He's got just as much energy as he's had, and he's really giving it his all here. I just have to really commend him. With all his problems, with all the things he was going through, he came through with a beautiful performance. And I love this. I love this secret entrance to the castle. You know, you see the foliage all around them. And the monster is so exhausted at this point. You know, you almost hear him grunting as he got up. And I saw when I saw it. Okay. Here's Bud and Lou getting ready for bed in their little apartment. I guess it's an apartment building. You're sure they're renting, definitely. But look at Bud. Bud's in his bathrobe and he's getting the couch ready. Bud's taking the couch? I don't know. I don't know about that.
It was a weak moment.
Okay, it's all right. We get it. I like this. Lou's descriptions of the monsters he encountered. And Bud is just totally disbelieving. Now, there are some wonderful outtakes during this scene, by the way. If you go to the Abbott and Costello outtakes on YouTube, or even on, whatchamacallit, I think it's on one of the extras here. But anyway, it's so funny when Lon Chaney enters soon. And there's at one point, Lou opens the door expecting Lon, and you see him, looking up almost. And it turns out to be Bobby Barber wearing a top hat. And Lou just slaps that thing off his head. It's very funny. If you could, take a look at these outtakes, you could see how much fun they're having. I don't believe. Okay, here's another theory I have. It's very famous that when Lou read the script right away, I don't believe this story. What would he be doing reading a script? apparently, When it was still The Brain of Frankenstein, the original title of this movie. Boy, was that horrible. In England, it was Abbott and Costello Meet the Ghosts, which was also kind of horrible. But anyway, what was I saying? So what was I saying?
I'm watching. You're talking about the outtakes, Lon Chaney, Bobby Barber.
Right. Yeah. Here's the thing. The famous story is that Lou read the script, went to Universal and said, this is a piece of crap. My three-year-old daughter can write better than this, blah, blah, blah. I don't believe that, to tell you the truth. Maybe he was against the idea of Abbott and Costello sharing the screen with, you know, monsters that weren't being utilized anymore. And, you know, that's understandable in a way. But I don't think he read the script and said, oh, this is terrible. Because if you look at the outtakes, and believe me, folks, the outtakes tell you everything. You'll see a bunch of people having a great time. They're just enjoying the hell out of themselves. So I don't believe it at all. I believe that they looked at this movie as something good because they bought into the whole Meet the Monsters thing, hook, line, and sinker. They realized that they had a good thing. They would have been stupid to think otherwise. So yeah. There's all these rumors you hear. There's all these legends, you know, and not just with Abbott and Costello, with all of these people. I just love to break the myths, you know? Okay. Look how tall Lon is. He's a big guy. He's a big fella, but he's slimmed down for this movie. He looks good. Lon was in a very bad way. During the filming of this movie, he was having marital problems, alcohol problems. He was very depressed. He even, once this movie wrapped, he tried to commit suicide, taking pills, washed down with booze. He survived. The ambulance got there in time, and he survived, luckily, because he had a lot of good performances left in him. And, I mean, really, yeah. If you ever saw High Noon or... what's the one where Tony Curtis and Sidney Poitier are handcuffed together? The Desperate Hours. No, that was Humphrey Bogart. Anyway, the one where they're handcuffed. He's terrific in that as well. So here we go. This was the scene that used to make me turn away when I was a little child, when I was a child. This, to me, was so scary, and I loved Lou so much that I had to care for him. I was really, really upset by this this scene. And apparently, when the movie was released, there were a lot of letters from mothers saying, what were they thinking? You lured my kid in with a comedy, and they were scared, you know, out of their pants. This is crazy. So this movie had that effect. But to me now, looking at it, it's one of the reasons why it's so great and why it's so respected and why it's probably more Abbott and Costello fans' favorite than any other. It's just so special and so different from anything they'd ever done before. So this is what they needed, and this put them right back on top. The orange. Oh, God. No, Lou, don't go back. Don't go back. No, Lou, don't go back.
Yes, this moment is played beautifully. I really love it.
What's he doing?
Oh, beautifully done. And I love that. That's what it's like. The chapter's closed now when he hits his head. I love the way he.
Ooh.
Brilliant. Just brilliant. Okay, this scene, which takes place in the insurance office, Mr. McDougal is yelling at Gil Stratton. And there's a lovely young lady, Jane Randolph, the actress, from The Cat People, Val Lewton's classic horror film from the 1940s. And she is the pretty investigator that's going to ask what's up with these monsters. Look at how cute she is. Jane Randolph loved making this movie in real life. She loved it. It's interesting because Val Lewton, the producer at RKO, who was given the job of making horror movies to compete with Universal, I didn't say international because it wasn't at that time. But anyway, so she was on the other team. She was on the Val Lewton team that looked down on the Universal monster movies. He made more sophisticated monster movies. And Jane Randolph was a big part of Cat People. She was the victim of the attacks. And she does that wonderful swimming pool scene where it's in the dark almost and you hear the cat, you know, very close by. And then the bus moment where she's walking down the street and she hears someone following her and she doesn't know who it is and it's dark and suddenly a bus stops right in front of her and it scares the crap out of everybody. So anyway, so she was part of that world and here she is working at Universal International. So she got around. She just insulted Sandra Mornay, just insulted Bud again. I hate her. Never mind, Bud. Just keep drinking. So here's Jane kissing Lou. Lou is just a chick magnet, and I don't mean Bud. Chick magnet, get it?
I get it. I don't like it.
Yeah, okay. Never mind. Okay, so this is the last movie Jane Randolph ever made, by the way. She got married a couple of weeks after they wrapped to a very, very wealthy millionaire and lived the rest of her life very comfortably and happily till about 2009, I think it was. She lived a long time and she was very happy. So that makes me happy because I like Jane Randolph. Look at that beautiful profile. She has a great nose. And Bud's not having it. He can't understand why do these beautiful women love this roly-poly little fella who probably smells of cigars and garlic. And oh, that's another line. You know, I'm not doing anything. Then you'll probably be very lonely. Bud, poor Bud. But this is a funny idea. The thing is about Lou, though, he's okay. You have Laurel and Hardy. Okay. There's absolutely no sex at all with Laurel and Hardy. They're both two funny looking guys, you know, and as much as I think they're beautiful in their own way, you know, in a movie buff kind of way, there's no sex there. You know, women don't watch Laurel and Hardy and go, oh, I wonder. But for some reason, Lou gets beautiful women in these movies. Sometimes he ends up with them. They always flirt with him. They're always trying to seduce him. You know, Lou gets a lot of action in these movies. Bud, not so much. And it's funny because in early interviews with them and newspaper articles that we, you know, in our research, a lot of times the writer will say, Lou Costello, the fat roly-poly one, da-da-da-da-da-da, and Bud Abbott, the better-looking of the two. I find that so interesting. I never found Bud, you know, a good-look and like a handsome man. You know, people look at them and think, well, Lou's short, he's fat, so he's not attractive. Then why do all these women, you know, fall all over themselves for him in the movies? Because I think he's a cute little guy.
Well, and but you know, there are
really,
there are certain... There are certain films where, you know, the characters in the film are trying to describe them, you know, go follow these two guys. One's short and pudgy. And often Bud is referred to as a hatchet face.
Yes. And he is. That's the kind of face he has. He has a weak chin, a prominent nose, and kind of beady little eyes. So he looks more like a con man to me. You know, he's got the perfect look for what he does, you know, in those sketches. So I think it's interesting here too, that they walk in on Lon's apartment and of course he wrecked it, you know, as the Wolfman, but they immediately think he's on a bender that he's been drinking. That's the first place they go.
Well, certainly.
Quiet. And Lon, true to his character, is tormented. He's like a tormental case. Now, a lot of people ask about this movie. Why is Larry Talbot / the Wolfman so intent on destroying these monsters? Now, obviously, he got word that they were coming to the States, and he followed them, and he tries to get some allies to help him. I love that mat of the castle, by the way. If I had a framed, I would frame that in on my wall. It's just beautiful. And now here they are doing their brief routine. John Grant woke up from a nap and said, wait a minute, let's put this in. So here they go. This is, you got two girls. Yours had teeth. Mine had so much bridge work, every time I kissed her, they had to pay toll. I had to pay toll. See, I screwed it up. I should have read the script. That's a joke I've been doing since I was a little kid. How about that? I speak French. That's Spanish. How about that? I speak Spanish, too. The other one I used all the time was, yes, ma'am. Ma'am? Yes, sir. Well, you got to be one or the other. All Lou Costello perennials.
Oh, yeah.
And here comes Charles Bradstreet, an actor who only made a few films, and for good reason. If you have to pick one weak link in this film, it would be I call him Dr. Boring. Dr. Boring would be the guy. He's there basically to be a love interest to Jane Randolph. And it works to a certain extent. You know, we do kind of, we're kind of pulled back into reality. Here's a very attractive woman, and naturally she's attracted to this attractive guy rather than Lou, who she has to be attracted to in order to get the information that she needs. And there's Sandra Mornay, a beautiful mirror shot. Look at the interiors. Look at the walls, the wallpaper, and the clocks on the what's that called, a chiffero? And those gorgeous chairs, the beautiful fireplace. Now, I'm sure this was all put together for this movie. And boy, oh boy, did they do a great job. The castle really is so memorable.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, his name is Professor Stevens. It's not Dr. Boring, but we'll call him Dr. Boring. I know what he'd like to be, boring. Quiet, will you please? Stop telling me to be quiet. Ow, bud, please. What am I, Lou? Look at that. Two women. And here's another John Grant coming in. I like the way he hangs his hat on Bud's fist. There's a time in everyone's life when they get in trouble. I'm in the middle of it. Well, I got two girls. Here we go. Everything comes in threes.
What's your name? We'll say her name is Mary. Is she pretty?
Beautiful. Naturally, she'd have to be. And you have Sandra. Your bosom friend. You take Mary. That is so John Grant. I mean, seriously. It's like, who's buried in John Grant's tomb? That joke. Dr. Lejos. That's a good name for Dracula, a good alias. Lejos.
Yeah.
And where did Lon get the number to the castle? That's way off on that island, off the coast of Florida. It's like, did he call information? You know? Could I have the number of Bela Lugosi? Really? It's funny though. He calls. He has the number. At least he's not taking a selfie with his phone.
Yeah.
Look at the scar over his. He has a scar over his eyebrow, his left eyebrow. I don't know how that happened. Lon was born dead. Did you know that?
Oh no.
When he was born, he was not breathing. And his father, Lon Sr., in a moment of inspiration, grabbed the baby, ran outside into the North American winter, broke through the ice in the lake, and put the baby into the ice water. And the baby started breathing. So we almost lost Lon Jr. But what a dramatic entrance. Okay, yeah. This is where they searched the castle. And, oh boy, this is where a lot of it for me gets started. This is where they go into that beautiful, beautiful basement set. And I used to love the idea. Look at that shot. That's so beautiful. Sorry, yeah. People who are just listening to this and not watching the movie, but it's a beautiful shot of the boys. Now, they come to the closets, and I love this when Lou says broom closet. And Bud's already looking in the broom closet. So he picks the wrong thing to say, of course. But look at that. Look at that beautiful stairway. Mm. You could just feel the dampness, you know, the moss growing on the stairs. Broom closet. He almost fooled you there, Bud. No, he didn't. I knew it wasn't the broom closet. Okay, you're smart. Okay. Certainly. Okay, so here they are going down those stairs, those scary stairs. Look at the brickwork. It looks like it's a million years old. It's just beautiful.
Yeah.
Charles Van Anger's photography, just gorgeous. And the door closes on Lou. He's like a child. He's a child. He's a child man. You know, I could watch this movie again and again and again. I never get sick of it. Never. It's amazing. It's one of those movies. And you know, I'm going to say something about our book, something that was heavily misunderstood, and it shows up in some of the reviews. I wrote in my opening chapter, in my introduction, I wrote that the work of Abbott and Costello should be studied like Commedia dell'arte and Shakespeare and Restoration comedies. And they were thinking, oh boy, he's overselling it. That's ridiculous. I didn't mean Abbott and Costello. Maybe I didn't phrase it correctly. I meant burlesque routines should be studied. And I still stand by that. But that's what I meant. Not just Abbott and Costello, but the whole world of burlesque comedy. Now, this is probably the most famous of the outtakes. If you're going to watch the Abbott and Costello outtakes, Lou does this shtick and Glenn Strange just can't keep it together. He just bursts out into laughter and turns around and says, I'm sorry, Charlie, who is Charlie Barton, the director. Now, the reason he's apologizing is apparently this happened quite a bit to the point where Lou got mad. He got angry and Glenn Strange had to apologize and say, I'm sorry, Lou, even the back of your head is funny. So he's doing the hand shtick, wondering why he has three hands and why one of them is probably bigger than both of his put together and probably green. Oh, this is so great. Now he sees the monster and he slips down underneath his clutching arms. Whoa, there's that scream again. And runs right into Dracula. Oh, this is so great. This is so great. And the wall that pivots around puts the candle. Beck. Now he calls him Abbott here. Listen closely when they cut and they go to the wall. Listen. I tell you, Abbott. I love that. He was so into the scene. And he calls the monsters like a dog, like dogs. Oh, this is so much fun. I ain't going near that place no more. Okay, this is just, he doesn't know where to go. They're coming at him. This used to scare me so much when I was a kid. Oh my God. And you know, it must have been difficult for Glenn Strange in those shoes to climb those stairs. And you saw him trip just now, just before they cut the scene. He trips. And there goes. There it goes. Oh, that music is just glorious. I love Bud's reenactment of the monsters. It's completely off.
What do you mean? It's perfect.
No, it's not, Bud. I'm sorry. Ow. Okay. It's perfect. It's perfect. Out. Yeah. Lou does it right.
Let's go upstairs. The girls are waiting for us.
Look at her. How beautiful. There's Lenore Arbert in her costume. It's funny that the good girl is wearing black and the bad girl's wearing white. Gotta love black and white movies. Okay. Now, this is where the women, who are smarter than the men, no doubt, find out about each other. Jane finds The Secrets of Life and Death by Dr. Frankenstein, with beautiful printing done by the Universal Beautiful Printing Department. Tonight we shall steal another body. And there's Lenore, who catches sight of this curious young lady, this suspicious, curious young lady. So she looks through her handbag to see who she is. And she's Joan Raymond, insurance inspector from outer space. No, I said that to make
dun,
it more
dun, dun.
Sorry. She's not from outer space.
She's from outer Philadelphia.
Never mind. Okay, so now they know they know what they're dealing with. And I love this. Lou is sitting in that chair that was in the Michael Schlesinger movie. And I love that he just gets up and screams at random. Mr. Talbot, same way.
You're both crazy.
I know. We heard him, Bud. Quiet. Oh, this is another great outtake, by the way, where Bela is coming down the stairway here, and Bobby Barber is behind him with his own cape. And Bela turns around and starts yelling at him, and they cut it. But Bela was serious. He was a serious actor. He took it very seriously. And by fooling around during one of his takes, it wasn't acceptable. But they do say that he had a good time making this movie. He got into the spirit of things, you know, with the pie throwing and everything. I don't think he ever got one. But he did enjoy watching everyone. But he did like spit water on people. There's actually a picture of him with Bud.
What?
No, I'm just mentioning your name. And they're spitting water on Bobby Barber. And here's Dr. Boring. He's ready to tell them all about his starch secrets when he does his laundry. That's how boring he is. And here they are. He's going to send Dr. Boring to the costume party they're all going to. Thank you. So he wants to get rid of the professor. He's going to send him to the costume party. And, of course, Lou's not happy about that because it might take one of his harem away. And look at that. He just right away, Dr. Boring just puts his eyes on Joan and kind of makes his claim at that moment. And Lou is very territorial. Now Dr. Noirne wants to beg off. She doesn't want to go through with the plans because she feels that Joan, as the insurance investigator, will make her move when they're all out there together. So she wants to excuse herself. And Lou says to Bud, "There goes your date." Now here, big mistake here, and I have to fault Mr. Barton
yes.
for this, especially. We all know that Count Dracula does not show up in a mirror. And unfortunately, boy, he shows up in this mirror. But the scene is somewhat saved by the fact that, and this is my sick mind, but watch Dr. Mornay's response while she's being bitten by Bela. Bitten by Bela. Well.
Yeah.
The Secrets of Life and... Okay, now watch.
Operation in such a hurry?
It's not the first, because there have been other orgasms depicted on screen and old movies. The first one I remember seeing is the movie Mad Love with Peter Lorre. He's watching a Grand Guignol play, and he's watching the woman of his dreams be abused physically. And when she screams, you see him close his eyes as his eyes roll up, and you know what's happening. Now watch Dr. Mornay. She's so beautiful. And now this is where Bela's age, you can see his age, the lines around his eyes and his forehead. Look at Dr. Mornay. I'm sorry, yep. But that was a little racy, just a tad racy.
Yep. And you're right. It does actually
you thought it was
save
racy,
that.
Didn't you, bud?
It does actually save that moment. Little segment right there. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you. So what? Quiet, bud. There, you know, we hear the screen. It's, you know, it's okay. Certainly. And now there's Mr. McNugle is dressed as the as Satan. He's dressed as the devil. And he might as well be to these two guys. Now this is John Grant again. They're doing a, you know, I want to see you do that again. As he throws Lou into the wall. Your word is better than his. And of course, the witness they get has a suit of armor on. And of course, the headpiece falls down just when he was supposed to see what was going on. One of the worst actors I think I've ever seen. I'm sorry, and there's Bobby Barber. Seen them? I don't even know them. I love Bobby Barber. Great friend of Lou's. Actually, they became friends the year before during Wistful Widow of Wagon Gap when Lou's father passed away. Bobby was there with a shoulder to cry on, and they became fast friends. And Bobby, like a lot of Italian men, was a very good stonemason. And he put together Lou's walkway at the Longridge estate where he lived. So that must have been fun, you know? Lou coming out with lemonade, you know, in a hot day while Bobby's laying down the brickwork. Okay, here's the most famous joke in the whole movie. You and 20 million other guys. That's serious. One of the greatest jokes ever written for any movie at any time. Now, if you read our book, you'll know that, I'm not sure if I mentioned this yet, but I was a comedian on the cruise ships for a while. And one night I had brought a VHS tape. This was back in the 90s. Of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And I was allowed to use the movie theater after midnight. So I invited the Korean staff. Did I mention this yet?
Jerry? You had referenced it. You had referenced it once. But go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what I did was I showed it that night, and there were a bunch of Korean people who did not speak English. And you should have heard the laughter. It was so amazing, and they were so happy and so complimentary afterwards. It was just fabulous. So this movie transcends age, race, creed, you know, cigarette brands. Yeah, cigarette brands. The Koreans liked it. I hope they were South Koreans. Dr. Lejos is dressed as Dracula at the costume party. I always thought that was clever that he got to wear his own clothing as a costume.
Yeah.
And Lou's got a cape too. I wonder. He was playing a monster as well. Yeah. And now Sandra is the slave to Dracula, and she wants to put the moves on Lou. Meaning, turn him into the undead. which is kind of interesting because they want his brain. Why would they want an undead brain in the monster? It would be a vampire's brain, you know? He would become a vampire if she bit him. And I'm trying to make sense out of this like it's something real. And look at this. Look at this beautiful, beautiful universal stage all dressed up. And even when I was a kid, I didn't know it was a stage setting. I thought they were really out there. And Lou acts this scene beautifully, by the way. You mm-hmm. see what a really good actor he is during this.
I want to be the only one. I want to be part of you.
I want to be in your blood. Now he gets a clue. He's got a little sore on his lip, on his bottom lip.
Wouldn't you want a prettier fellow than me?
I'm sorry. That's what you... Blu-ray. You see everything.
Yeah.
So round. So firm. So fully packed. So free and easy on the draw. Okay. Sorry, I've been watching too many Jack Benny shows. And if you don't know, that's the tagline for Lucky Strike cigarettes. So round, so firm, so fully packed. And Jack Benny's show had it as a sponsor for years and years. So now, look into my eyes. This is so cool. When he sees the bats in her eyes.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. That's just beautiful. You see the little sore on his lip?
Yeah.
You see it? Yeah. I think he was kissing the dog again. Or something. He says, I'll bite. You know, when I was a kid, I had no idea what that meant. It was the first time I ever heard it. You know, and of course you look it up, you wait to hear it again, you know, whatever, and then you understand it. But I didn't.
Yeah.
I'll bite? What the hell does that mean? Make sure you have plenty of bandages.
Do you know what could happen if I need to
move? Oh, no, you got to stand in line. Okay. I have a little, this is why the movie's near perfect. It's not perfect. It's near perfect. And this scene is one of the reasons it's not perfect. Now, here's the contrivance. They're walking around the woods looking for Joan, who has disappeared with Count Dracula. So you've got Lon Chaney and Lou in one section of the forest. Bud is off on his own. I was smoking a cigarette. I know. And a full moon comes up and Lon takes off his coat, takes off his tie, does a little striptease, and becomes the Wolfman. Now, here's the contrivance. Bud has a wolf mask, and he was asked not to wear it by Lon Chaney. He made him uncomfortable. So Lou thinks that Lon, the Wolfman, is Bud wearing the wolf mask. So What does he do? He starts doing something that he would never do in real life. It's so out of character, and it makes me uncomfortable watching the scene. He starts punching who he thinks is Bud. He punches him in the face. He abuses him. He yells at him. He would never do that. He would never do it. It's all because we're supposed to be frightened because it's the Wolfman. It's the real Wolfman. And I get it, you know, but it's just Lou's out of character here. It doesn't play honestly. See? Oh, yeah, he would do that to Bud. He would punch him in the face. I'd kill him. All right, Bud. Have another drink. Here you go. So here they are. He's very clumsy, the Wolfman. Tripping, getting stuck under logs. I mean, now look, this is what he'd do to Bud. He'd kick him in the butt and hit him and slap him. No, he wouldn't. And there they go. All right, so the Wolfman's not done yet. He's going to head to probably the person who deserves to be bitten more than any other, and that's Mr. McDougal. He's the one that ordered the monsters to the States. He's the one that started this whole thing. They just missed his jugular vein. W.C. Fields used to have a jugular vein. He was a jugular. Someone in a wolf's mask. And there's Joe Kirk to the right of Bud. Dressed up, waiting to say his line. Lou's brother-in-law. And Lou makes it worse. Uh-oh. McDougal's not having any of it. He thinks they're both in on it together. And Joe Kirk is running after his brother-in-law. There he is. I love, there's photographs. There's actual photographs of the Costello home where it could be any Italian table in Brooklyn. Like 3,000 people eating food that could feed a small country. And Joe Kirk is always there. He's always, he always looks like, you know, Uncle Joe. Uh-oh. Now this is where, okay, now they do the reverse animation of Dracula becoming, going back into the bat. And he's chasing Lou. Look at that. Look at that setting. Look at it. It's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
There's the water, the moss, the trees. And there's Joan in the boat waiting. And she's in a trance. She's in her Dracula-induced trance. You've gone bats, too. Wilbur! He spells Wilbur, W-I-L-B-A. Wilbur! And now Bud sees Dracula. The animated Dracula become the actual thing. Lou faints. He turns to Bud, who is transfixed, and Bud faints. That's a great scene. And I love the music when they fall. Bump! Bump! And the boat is off on that misty lake, that mysterious misty lake. The next morning, we see Lon, now himself, Larry Talbot, waking up after an evening of wolfing. And there's McDougal with a shotgun in his hand and a bandage around his throat, around his jugular vein. And there's Bud trying to stay out of the way because he's being hunted. And now this is the first, this is the scene where I say Bud could do anything. Bud could act in any movie. And now he believes his partner.
I'm going to give myself up. It's the only way to clear you. Then you worry a little about that wolf business.
Look at Bud. He's terrific.
Dracula's taking Wilbur and Joan to the island.
And see, he even took on Lou's line. Do you remember it, Bud?
Hey, Abbott.
No, not that one. There they go. Look at that setting. Even with the bright lights, it looks great.
Mm-hmm.
The bloodhounds are barking. And, you know, bloodhounds would chase a vampire. Makes sense, doesn't it? You might even call Dracula a bloodhound.
Ooh.
There better not be any maybe. And now this. When I was a kid, everybody watched this movie when I was a kid. And we all talked about it the next day. And this was one of the scenes we loved. Junior. Sandra. Junior. Why does he call him Junior? That's another thing. Junior. He's not like intimidated by the monster. But he makes up pet names for him.
Yeah.
And now here's the guy spoiling the party. Here comes Dracula. What a great shot of Bella.
Mm-hmm.
Look at him. And I love this. Lou tries to hide his eyes and has to put his pinky in front of the exposed eye. It's just beautiful Lou stuff. Wait, everybody's calling Dracula Master. He's growing weaker. and his ring somehow gives him electrical energy on his he's growing weaker on his little posts in his neck, which is something I always thought was kind of cool when I was a kid. You know, it's like he had this little storage unit on his finger of electricity. Boy, I'd like to play nurse with her. Of course, she'd be the nurse. Aww. You'll live forever and you'll never grow old. Boy, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Aww. I love he finds out how she's going to do it. I'll remove your brain and put it in his body. All right. And put it in Junior's body? Oh, for a minute, I didn't know how you were going to do it. A ping. That was something he took on later. That ping noise. A ping.
Yep.
When
yep.
he would realize something. Okay. Now, Dr. Boring is a little angry. He found the book. The only Everything But My Temper. Okay. Now Sandra shows how valuable she is by hitting Boring with a fire extinguisher on the head. More of a Boring extinguisher.
And then I never realized before that there are no actual doors into this lab. They're all secret, you know, through the wall door. That's the only way you can get in this room.
Yeah. I guess that's you kind of have to, you know, when you have equipment set up to, you know, revitalize a monster. You don't want to have a big sign saying enter, you know. That must be the entrance to the castle film. Now, Bud does something here that I take umbrage with. Bud should have known better. Hold on. First, we have to see. Look at that. Look at the setting. You could feel the weight of that door, that stone door. Yeah. And now they're bringing in Dr. Boring. He's been knocked out. And I love how unceremoniously they knock him off the table. They just dump him. Watch.
Boom.
He even lands Boring. Now, don't you find it interesting that the monster in this movie speaks? Because if you're a fan of the Universal movies, the last one made was House of Dracula, where Frankenstein appears, or the monster appears, and he doesn't have a voice. He doesn't speak. He doesn't speak in House of Frankenstein, which is the second to the last movie. The only way he spoke in these movies was as Igor, Bela Lugosi's voice, because Igor's brain was put into the monster. So right now, in this movie, he actually has Igor's brain. And he should be talking like Bela Lugosi, but that would be confusing because Bela Lugosi is bringing him back to life. So it would be a little, you know, like talking to himself, you know.
Yeah.
He's growing weaker. Yes, I am. Yes, you are. Stop talking like me. I'm not talking like you. Anyway, it would go on like that. And John Grant would probably write it. Now, this is my thing about Bud. Here he does. He accidentally puts the rock on Lou's hand while he's trying to get the thing off his neck. But you see him purposely place it there where he shouldn't have been looking. See, he put it there like he knew he was putting it there. And it kind of takes away from it. He should have been looking at the work he was doing and absent-mindedly putting the rock on Lou's hand. But you see, that's why it's near perfect. Now, this was the most quoted line from childhood when I would go to school. Lou runs into the wall, comes back, and just says, "No door." And Bud treats him like a 3-year-old. Okay, they are strapping down the monster and attaching the electrodes to his posts, and now Lon and Dr. Boring have to go help Joan. All right. So Lou is in charge of untying the boat, something he is definitely bad at.
Yes.
He's bad at it later in the movie. Untie the boat, will you please? Let's not give it away yet, bud, okay? All right, sorry. All right, so here he is, untying the boat. And I love this shot of Bela. He looks so good. This could have been the original Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
That's how good he looks.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Lou's about to do one of my favorite things. And I think I remember you saying this too.
Yes.
Is when he starts skipping. His truth comes out, you know? He's a 9-year-old. Oh, he's so good. You can't tell me he didn't like the script. I'm sorry. They're having too much fun. Look at him. Like a sad sack. And I noticed that the little sore on his lip is gone. Now watch. He's walking. He's doing the Lou walk. He starts skipping to his doom. Skip to my Lou. Wilbur! Now they have to go back and save Wilbur. And, okay, I'm going to put myself out on a limb here. But although it's not one of their classic chases, which usually takes place with some sort of conveyance, like a sailboat on wheels or a car out of control or, a stagecoach out of control. This is the two of them on their 2 feet, and I think it's their best chase ever. This whole sequence, starting now, is just... It's breakneck. It leaves you breathless. That's how good it is.
Yep.
And this is horrifying. This is what justifies her being thrown out of a window later. This is horrifying. Please give me a little ether. No, we don't need it. You won't feel the thing. Look at her. She's just about to cut into his head. Lon grabs her. Attaboy, Lon. And Bud is trying to deal with Dracula. So Lon pushes, and then Bud goes to hit him with a chair and hits Dr. Mornay instead. Yeah, you're right. Look at that. It's like a barn door.
Yeah.
Now this was, you talk about scary scenes. Lou is strapped down. He can't get away. And there's a full moon. And he's already changed. This is, seriously, this is scary. He pushes away as the table rolls right into Dracula, and now the two of them are pushing Lou back and forth. I love this. I just love this. It's incredible. Okay, now we're about to go into the... in our book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, this section, I say it's, what is it? Lon looks strange. Now, let me explain that. Glenn Strange actually hurt his ankle, lifting up Dr. Mornay and walking towards the window, and he couldn't do it. So Lon volunteered to go under the makeup and become the Frankenstein monster just for this shot. So Lon looks strange. Get it?
Yeah.
Okay, now here comes Dr. Mornay, and she's about to learn where one of the exits is in this building. There we go. And that, he's about to hurt his ankle. And now Lon is going to throw her out of the window. This always horrified me when I was a kid. Because I had such a crush on her, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's Lon. Definitely looking different. Okay, now it begins. This is just breakneck, Abbott and Costello at their best, Charles Barton at his best. Just incredible. Okay, pushing the bed up against the door. And of course, the door opens out. Ha ha. And this answers the question, what if the Frankenstein monster was chasing you in a normal circumstance, meaning in a normal home with beds and chairs, and, you know, not in a windmill or in a burning building or whatever. This is just rooms.
Yeah.
And they're dealing with these monsters. Here he comes. Oh, this is great. This is great. And I love that keeps... Now, you see how Bud hesitated there. He stopped because he knew he had to wait for his cue. Okay, here we go. Lou's going to do his trick. And that was on the level. He pulls what is it called? He pulls the sheet out from under the things on the chiffero. And now he's pretending to be Dracula, hiding behind the cloth. He thinks I'm Dracula. That was another heavily quoted thing when we were kids. We loved it. Okay, now we have to see, what are those two guys up to? You see, this is what I mean by typical. The monster is pushed into a regular room and the door is closed on him. You know, rather than a torch being put in his face and, you know, being pushed into a pit of sulfur. Now Lou's standing a little too close and got hit with the fist at that point. Lou needed to listen a little more closely.
Certainly.
We know, Bud. Okay. Now here they are. He throws a vase at the wolfman. That'll do a lot. Okay, he turns into a bat. The wolfman grabs the bat and they both fall to their doom in the waters below. Now, my problem with that is,
yes,
and we talked about it in the Abbott and Costello episode, Abbott and Costello Me Frankenstein episode. You can't kill them like that. The Wolfman needs a silver bullet, or he needs to be beheaded.
Yep.
Or Count Dracula can only die with a stake through the heart, you know, or sunlight. So I just imagine they're still alive now, and they're probably swimming or something.
Yeah.
And here comes our monster friend. Boy, oh boy. Talk about a gate crasher.
Yeah.
Look at the setting behind them. You see, these are the things that I love about them. Every detail is just perfect. And look at that shot from up, from below. And McDougal and his gun-toting friend see the monster and jump into the water. And our boys are doing the same thing. They're seeing the boat. Lou jumps in.
Untie the boat, will you please?
Now, the monster can't jump in the water. I mean, that would be terrible. You know, the swim fins of Frankenstein. That'll be the next movie. The water wings of Frankenstein. Now he's throwing barrels at the boys. Barrels at the boys. Wow, wow, wow. All right. Now, Dr. Boring got the idea to take the gasoline that is, you know, reserved for the motorboat. And he's going to light the dock on fire.
Untie the boat, will you please?
We heard it, Bud. Okay?
Sorry.
Oh, it's all right. And there they go. They untied it, and Dr. Boring becomes the hero of the day. He lights the dock on fire. Now, this I didn't understand when I was a kid. Why is the monster walking into the fire? He's throwing a thing in it, more wood to make more fire. But he's just actually trying to go through it to get to Dr. Boring. He was throwing the ladder at Dr. Boring. Okay, so now the puppet is going up in flames and falls through into the water. Now, you can't kill Frankenstein that way, or the monster that way either. You have to dissect it. It's the only way to kill him. And now the boys are wrapping things up.
Now that we've seen the last of Dracula, the Wolfman, and the monster.
And there's our friend Vincent Price. He's the Invisible Man. And Bud and Lou's stuntmen jump into the water and swim away. As Bud and Lou are probably playing cards in their dressing room.
Yeah.
And here's the music. Da, da, da. What a great cast.
Oh, yeah.
And Dr. Stevens. Oh, God. Charles Bradstreet. the most boring actor in America. Ooh, I'm dropping my computer. Okay, so there we are. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't Leonard Maltin. It wasn't Leonard Maltin. It wasn't Facts and Figures. It was basically just a lot of memories about watching it as kids and just commenting on what we were watching, you know, how special it is and just what a wonderful film it is. Now, Jerry, you made it clear that it's not your number one Abbott and Costello film. I know that's Whodunit, which is a great choice. But where, you know, watching it again, where do you put it? Give me your thoughts.
Okay, I will do that. It is, as a film, as you've said, it's near perfect. And for the experience, really nothing comes close. You know, you mentioned Mel Brooks commenting on Lou Costello doing the best scare takes in the business. And I think it was our last episode when we did our top five each. And I mentioned when Gene Wilder first came to Mel Brooks with the idea for Young Frankenstein, Brooks' knee-jerk reaction was comedy, horror movie, been done, Abbott and Costello, nothing better. And I have to agree, there is nothing better. And of all of their Meet the Monster movies, obviously this one is the number one. It's
without a doubt.
It's a great movie. I will grant that till my dying day. It's a great movie. I like to watch Abbott and Costello to laugh. This has laughs, but again, Whodunit, which was my number one choice, is all laughs. So, you know, there's the comparative.
Oh, it is. Right. It is.
Yeah.
I getcha. That's a good assessment. I guess I find it funnier than you do. I find the comedy very strong and character driven as opposed to, well, you know, Whodunit is also character driven, you know, you can believe their characters. But in this movie, again, Matthew, my co-author, kind of, and for me, and no offense, Matthew, but I think he erroneously claims that this is the movie that changed everything, that they became like a kiddie act at this point. I disagree. They didn't become a kiddie act. They became different. Their movies became different. They became a bit more mature. And like I said, the movies became more story driven. They had to act more, you know? So I don't know. I think that all started two movies before this. I think it was Buck Privates Come Home. That's the movie that changed everything. Mm. That's the one where they became real people. You believe them. You believe the story. And I'm not discounting Little Giant or The Time of Their Lives, but those were more specials. They were more, I don't know, I don't want to say a freak thing, but they were definitely different. But Buck Privates Come Home sort of informed the rest of their movie career. And what I mean by that is strong stories, less crosstalk routines, less music, you know, and more story-driven Abbott and Costello stuff. So this was part of that, not the beginning, but part of that. The only thing it was the beginning of was their meeting the Universal Monsters, you know, and what a great idea. And I'm sure that back in the day, when a new one was released, it was like an event, you know, that the kids must have lined up around the block. But you heard what I just said. Kids must have lined up around the block. So Matthew is correct about that, but I don't think his timing is right as far as which movie changed them. It was definitely Buck Privates Come Home.
Yeah.
So anyway, I want to say in my usual hyperbolic way, I believe this movie should be right up there with Chaplin's City Lights, with Keaton's The General, with Fields' It's a Gift and The Bank Dick, and with the Marx Brothers' Duck Soup. I think it's that good. And for some reason, they are just not in the pantheon. They are not taken seriously. And, you know, I didn't mention Laurel and Hardy, like Sons of the Desert or Way Out West. The funny thing about Abbott and Costello, and the interesting thing to me, is that when they're thought of, if they're thought of at all, it's because of two things, only two things. Who's on first and Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. That's it.
Yep.
So I could see why, if you're a fan of the boys and you like this podcast, I could see why you like it. We are giving them full credit. We are giving them the respect they deserve, and we're putting them right where they belong. And that's alongside all of those greats that we mentioned.
Yes.
So that's that. This was a lot more fun than I thought it was going to be. I hate to say that, but it's true. I wasn't sure what to expect, you know. But it was great having you here, Ghost of Bud. Thank you for being here.
Certainly. Ow. Why did you have to do that? So you'd remember me.
All right. Every time I look at this black eye, I'll remember you.
He definitely made an impression on you, yes.
Yes, he did, on my Bud Abbott impression. But, so anyway, this was episode 50. What yes. is that? What kind of gifts would we get? Would that be the Naugahyde year or linoleum, maybe? I don't know what you would call it.
It's the Limburger cheese sandwich gift.
If you think I'm getting in there with that Limburger, you're crazy. All right. Well, let's say our goodbyes. We've really had a good time. Thank you, Jerry. I had a wonderful time.
Yeah, me too.
And I hope everyone else did as well. And what an opportunity to watch this movie again, you know, even with our annoying commentary. In the meantime, we will see you on episode number 51. I'm really not sure what we're doing on episode 51, but we will come to it, and you can guarantee it'll be a lot of fun. So, ladies and gentlemen, remember to hit subscribe. Very quickly, Jerry, very occasionally I get invited to a Zoom conversation with a bunch of film historians and authors. And these are all people that I respect very much, and I've read their books and all that stuff. And two of them are big fans of our podcast, which I didn't know. And it's just wonderful. They had questions. They were excited about the next episode and all this. So we're attracting some good people. And I hope everyone's enjoying it as much as we enjoy doing it. Yeah, I speak for Jerry for that. I hope I'm not being presumptuous, but I have a feeling we both feel the same about that. You don't feel the same about that. Okay. I have to tell you, Jerry's sound is off. He moves his lips, and then I hear the sound about 5 seconds later. So he was commenting on something beforehand. So anyway, I doubt anyone knows what the hell I'm talking about. So everyone, please stay safe. It's a crazy world out there right now. Stay healthy and stay happy. And we will see you next time on Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, episode number 51. Jerry, you take good care of yourself, pal. That's a great shirt, by the way, you're wearing. I wish I could describe it to people.
It's the Al Hirschfeld caricatures of the Marx Brothers. So that about describes it.
Right. Definitely the ones that were the most used when we were kids and they were advertising them in movie theaters, actual movie theaters. It was always those Hirschfeld drawings, which were not my favorites, to be honest with you.
Yep.
But your shirt is beautiful.
Thank you.
In the meantime, everyone, take good care of yourself. I'm saying goodbye again. And Jerry, you take good care of yourself. Say hello to your lovely wife and your lovely son with the great haircut. And we will talk to you next time. Thanks for joining us.